day. But basically, the vets do speeches. We kind of got fed up with the whole rally thing and preaching to the choir thing. So what we're trying to do is go around and make networks and connections between all of the groups who are getting fucked by this government.
Do you get a chance to go into high schools to talk at all, or outside the high school?
That's one of the things we really want to do. We haven't had a chance to do it yet, but it's definitely on our list. Inner city schools and impoverished areas and lower income areas, the people who are really getting hit hard by recruiters and the people who are profiting from this war.
Basketball courts too.
We actually have a basketball goal set up on the back of our bus, so we can just park our bus somewhere and have a 3-on-3 or whatever.
Yeah, there's a lot of recruiting being done in Pittsburgh at the basketball courts. Drive up in a real snazzy car, you know, the recruiter looks really good.
Helping friends or family members or family members who come back from Iraq.
What about? What was the question?
That's a really, really difficult, touchy subject because of the things that they are dealing with. Like I said, it took me years before I could speak to my family. I guess getting, like, when a soldier comes back, they are a different person. So you're going to have to get to know this person again as a different person. You're going to have to build a relationship before you can. It's possible to get into what's causing them to be depressed, or before you can hear any of the stories that they're willing to tell. And on this tour, I've definitely told more about my experience than I have my own family since I've been back. It's something to do with dealing with what you've done and the things you've taken part in that causes you to kind of shut yourself off, because you're going to have to deal with those things and get through those things with yourself before you're able to come out to your family or friends and talk to them about it. And it does take a long time.
It's like what happened to Steve yesterday. He's been back for like a year and a half. And like, that was the first panic attack he had that bad. And he never knew he was gonna have to walk around with, you know, medication in his pocket in case that happens again, you know. You learn as it goes on.
But now he knows what that is, you know. And that's what scared him most, is not knowing what is going on with himself. That was really big for him. He feels a lot better about knowing what it was now. A lot better.
When that happened, did medical care here, and did they know what it was? Because you said that often they can't feel it.
Yeah, we called the ambulance, came, and the guy that was in the back with him said he has a friend with PTSD, and that he stays up with him some nights where he can't sleep, so I guess we kind of lucked out. Yeah. And we went to a VA hospital, and he came out with this nurse who seemed pretty cool. He said they're getting along pretty good.
Well, tell the reaction that we had when he came up rolling up with a camera.
Not a lot of videotape on the country.
I could tell you, I registered in the VA in January 2003, and now I can get health care there, and so I make $24,000 a year. But the guy told me that it just went down that month, that in 2002 it was $30,000. So January 2003 is like you know, a few months after mission accomplished or whatever in Afghanistan, and the invasion of Iraq was a couple months later, so right in the middle. And they cut the benefits, and that was a damn drastic cut. These guys, did you go to that commission? The disability commission? Were they trying to, like, make PTSD not as...
Catherine Harris's aide during the 2000 elections was there, and she was on the board, and I don't know how that happened. She should not be on the Veterans Disability Commission. We had a bunch of veterans testify. First off, before the commission, they said that some of the people on the board said that, I just want everybody to know that this transcript is available to the public, and anybody that wants to can go online and go to our website and print it out anytime. Later on, we found out that that wasn't the case because you have to pay a $300 fee or something like that to get onto the website to print it. So I started videotaping, and they got a little freaked out. The woman didn't want me to videotape, and we just told her we were a bunch of vets, and you know, we were going to, and it's public record, so they said okay. And there was a lot of talk about why should we continue paying veterans benefits to such a large number of veterans? Because after all, a lot of veterans are just disabled because they got hurt playing basketball. And they didn't even cover, there was in the agenda for the schedule, they were supposed to talk about, you know, hazardous materials and radiological, biological weapons and all that stuff, depleted uranium. Somehow that got completely skipped because they felt that something that was much less important needed to be talked about twice. So they didn't even talk about that. And in the room there was a bunch of veterans on one side, and then the other side was just these old, rich white men in suits there to, you know, secure their business deal or whatever. And you know, it was pretty sickening. You know, a bunch of basketball injuries.
I got the footage on YouTube.
Yeah. Go to YouTube. The profile is IVAW American Values.
All one word.
On
YouTube, type in search IVAW American Values. Those are just the testimonies, though, because I don't have time to edit all the what those people said. That will figure shortly.
But the point is, like, soldiers shouldn't have to fight for their benefits. They do fight for their benefits, but. Afghanistan, went to this base that was sending all these supplies to Kuwait, which I felt at that time, a year before we invaded Kuwait, that, like, I knew we were going to go to war with Iraq. Now that it's all said and done, and Afghanistan is just like some kind of NATO problem now, I mean, I can't imagine how a soldier would feel to get orders to go to Afghanistan, knowing that we're not trying to win that war at all. I can't imagine.
As far as PTSD, and I know that they're actually, what I understand, what I've heard is they're actually debating on whether they're even going to fund treatment for it. But I was wondering if you could talk about how, like, the drugs play into that, or what kind of pills they try and give people, and what the pills do, if you're familiar with that at all. Or if they do try and give pills, or what they do when you go in, or obviously not saying, well, here's, you know, 2 years of 24-hour access to some trained professional you can talk to, right? Okay.
The pills they gave Steve yesterday, it's like generic Valiums and Xanax. The withdrawals from those, if you're a heavy addict, you can die from shock when you quit. You know? So, seems like they tried to send Steve out of there a junkie yesterday. And luckily, you know, with my prior drug experience on the streets, luckily I was able to let Steve know how dangerous that was. In Afghanistan, they had a lot of people smoking opium, though, and they didn't know it was addictive. They'd smoke opium every day, they'd get on a plane to come home, and they get sick. They don't know why. Somebody gives them methadone.
Were the drugs in Afghanistan readily available, like on the street?
On Bagram Air Base, there's like a little elementary school right in the middle of the base, and little school kids would sell hash, opium, AKs, pistols.
And the American authorities weren't upset about that.
I was surprised. When I started talking to the Iraq veterans, I was surprised. Like, they had to shave and all kinds of stuff when they were in Iraq. When I was in Afghanistan, it was really lax. Like, people smoked opium everywhere. People that growing goatees and stuff. I guess they knew. The commanders knew we weren't trying to win that war at that time. I don't know.
Now would be a good time to steer the discussion towards counter-recruitment efforts. And one of the things that we've been doing on the tour is we have a bunch of people from different cities who've been organizing counter-recruitment. Obviously, I'm with Pittsburgh and have been working with Pittsburgh Organizing Group. Kate here is from Students Against War in UC Santa Cruz. Tom is with Cleveland and has been doing counter-recruitment there. Tristan, bless you. Tristan is from Chicago, has been doing counter-recruitment stuff. Tarek, well, he's now sitting back there. He's been doing counter-recruitment organizing in GMU and Virginia. Maybe I hope I'm not leaving anyone out. But, what?
Ryan.
B-Mar.
There you go.
I think he's in the kitchen. He just keeps coming.
So, anyway, so one thing that maybe as a kind of way of transition, you know, like, what do you guys think is some of the most effective tactics that can be used, you know, for counter-recruitment, for intervening at the level of the at the recruiter, you know, and stopping the flow of recruits?
Getting in contact with people, with the students at schools, handing out information regarding lies that the recruiters tell you, or things you really should ask before seeing a recruiter. Getting recruiters out of schools and out of colleges and off campuses, because those are the places where recruiters prey on young, inexperienced people who don't really know what to expect and what's going on and what they're going to be a part of. People who just are looking for a way out or an easy start. I have a lot of nieces and nephews. I have a huge family, so every time I think about these recruiters in high schools, and I think about them going to school and having to deal with this, having to, as young as they are, deal with the rhetoric and the propaganda that these recruiters spit out every day. I mean, I fell for it. And I consider myself a pretty intelligent person. It's just disgusting to me to think about how these recruiters prey on the young people, the people who don't see and they can't find another way out. It's criminal.
Just like someone said about recruiters know all these little things about the people they're trying to recruit. It wouldn't hurt for you to get to know the people you're trying to stop from joining the military. Like, why do you want to join the Army so bad? You know?
Another thing is that what a lot of the recruiters use is they play into the macho thing, and all of that. So, I mean, if you just go there and you hand somebody a pamphlet out of school, chances are they're probably just going to throw it out right away. But if, you know, you start creating relationships within your own community of people that are, you know, of high risk, then, you know, you can do certain things. Like this woman said, go to a basketball court, and then, you know, while you're, like, I roll up, and when I go play, I roll up in there, and I got, you know, Iraq Veterans Against the War bumper stickers and a lot of stuff like that. And, you know, if somebody says, like, oh, you're just against the war because you're not a man or whatever like that, blah, 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 you know, and then you're stuffing a ball in their face and saying, like, what up, you know, like, what do you think now? And it's a lot harder for them to do that. So, I mean, you know, and you can do good outreach like that. I mean, you got to make it, like, we got to try and find a make it so that it's fun for people to learn. You know, like we sit here and talk about all kinds of things, like, you know, the Solomon Amendment and, you know, Iraq on the Record as prepared by Henry Waxman and all that stuff. And it's kind of like, you know, like we joke about it, like, nerd alert, you know, like, because, you know, I mean, that's just not your average teenager isn't thinking about going online and studying some congressional record, you know. We got to try and figure out a way to make it fun. We got the basketball idea, you know. Everybody can think of something. So.
And as far as long term, just in general, I think we need to be less dependent on the federal government. So they hold this all this money over our heads, saying we'll give you this if you let recruiters in. Well, why can't we get our own books for schools? You know, why can't we paint our own schools and buy air conditioners for our own school?
Can you talk about the ratio a little bit with black and white soldiers? Because, you know, when they do on the McNeil layer, you see a lot of white faces. And if they recruit, you'd think that African Americans would be going because they don't have jobs so easily as well.
Well, sometimes you can be like so poor, so oppressed. Just take a look at the African American population. 1 in 5 black men dies before 25.
Yeah.
So already 20% of black youth you can't recruit. What, like 2 out of 5 are in jail? So that's 3 out of 5 right there. Now you're left with 2 out of 5. Some of them are so poor and so oppressed they can't pass the test to get into the military, even though they'd love to go. And they don't care what war they go to. They just need to work so bad, they just can't do it. And prison records that will keep you out of the military. So we this country tends to enslave African Americans in the prison system more than the military-industrial complex. But Latinos recruitment, I think, is going up. So a lot of counter-recruiting needs to be done in Spanish areas, Latino areas.
Because the federal government makes laws that you can get a green card for Americans just by counter-recruiting. And they're making the rules against undocumented immigrants stricter and stricter, making it harder to survive without documentation, so kind of forcing a lot of Latino youth into the
military. So I've worked with a lot of guys that aren't U.S. citizens, the Philippines, all that.
A recent Pentagon document came out, gave a statistic that since the invasion of Iraq, 60% of the people who have been involved in the invasion, both the invasion and the occupation of Iraq, have been Latino. So that just kind of puts in perspective, especially since it's estimated that 13 to 15% of the population of Americans are Latino. But it's also, they're also targeting heavily, like, especially like rural and poor white youth, playing off both their economic conditions and the overt patriotism that with politics that are so ingrained in those parts of the country.
Also on that note, I think it's like the third fastest growing reason for going to prison is for immigration offenses. So, like you know, go to prison or join the military. When I was in the Air Force, in the barracks right next to mine in basic training was a unit that was all from Puerto Rico and they couldn't speak English. And they're not allowed to be citizens. Well, you can come join the military and then we'll let you be citizens. So they really use that against people.
So maybe some of us who have been involved in counter-recruitment work could kind of sum up what we've been doing. How does that sound to folks?
Sounds good.
So I'll start. I'm a student at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And what we've been doing is focusing on recruitment on the campus. Because of the Solomon Amendment, the university has to allow recruiters onto the campus whenever they have other employers on campus. So that's twice a year at the two job fairs. And we started Students Against War January 20th, 2005. And at every job fair since then, we've had big demonstrations. The first time we had a giant march and kicked the recruiters off campus. We were yelling and screaming until they left. The second time we had a queer kiss-in to highlight the military's discrimination policy against queers, which conflicted with our university's non-discrimination policy, which says that they're not allowed to have discriminatory employers. So we just lined up a bunch of, like, 12 queer couples, and we were just making out for a couple hours so nobody could get to the recruiters. And then this past spring, we had another giant demonstration until the recruiters left. And at this point, it looks like the military recruiters are not coming back to Santa Cruz because they're embarrassed. It looks bad for them because it's national news whenever we do it. And it makes the military recruiters look really vulnerable. So they're not signed up to show up at the next job fair. So that's been pretty successful in getting a lot of national attention about counter-recruitment and I think inspiring a lot of counter-recruitment efforts around the country. Somebody else want to go?
Tara, where'd you go?
Yeah,
well, on my campus, GMU is kind of, it's a really hard place to do activism. It doesn't have much of a history of a lot of that, and it's really conservative school. It's actually like one of the top schools for getting money from conservative foundations. It was really hard to like organize anything. So I just started doing stuff by myself, like little things. Like if it was between classes and there was a recruiter's table set up, you know, I have an hour, I would just put a sign on my chest that says "Recruiters lie, don't be fooled," and just stand right next to his table and have pamphlets on me to give to anyone who asked for them so that people go up to the table, talk to the recruiter, they can talk to me too because I've been in the military and I can tell them a lot of the truth that the recruiter's not going to tell them. And I mean, that's a pretty small scale thing, but that's something that it's really easy to do if anyone can do, especially if you're in a place that it's really hard to organize. But as a result of that, I got arrested and a bunch of bad media came on the campus. As a result of that, and the school looked really bad in a lot of papers and on TV, and so they finally let me start a student group. They would never let me do that before. So we started an anarchist group on campus. The reason why I wanted to make it an anarchist group was because when my first semester on campus, I tried to start a group that wasn't really anarchist, but they said to me, "Well, you guys are anarchists, you can't have a group." So then once we had them in our pockets, and they had all this bad media, and they were like, "Oh no, you can have a group," and I'm like, "Okay, well, it's going to be an anarchist group." we've just been doing kind of things like, little things like that, like setting up tables next to the recruiters, like, we'll find out what times the recruiters are scheduled to be there, and then we'll schedule a table to be right next to them when they're there. with all kinds of anti-militarist literature, and usually they don't stay very long. Usually they, like, they'll be scheduled for 2 hours, they'll leave after like 45 minutes because we just make them look stupid, and it's fun.
What's your university?
George Mason University in Virginia.
My name's Tom. I do counter-recruitment work with the Northeast Ohio Anti-War Coalition up in Cleveland. And we decided to take a little bit of a different approach. We didn't try and, you know, have a lot of pamphlets and a bunch of stuff like that. But we, our collective, sat there and tried to figure out, like, what generates military recruitment. We figured there were a couple of things in our area that generate military recruitment. One was, you know, the myths of patriotism and state and government and, you know, capitalist institutions and things like that, and the lies that we're fed when we're children, and how that, you know, impacts our culture, and how that impacts our environment, and how that environment impacts our socialization. And secondly, the poverty in our area caused by globalization. So we went after recruitment in a little bit of a different way. Our counter-recruitment campaign was really image-heavy. So we printed up our own posters, handed them out at DIY shows and punk shows, like people pasted them up all over town. We had like these little drop cards that looked almost exactly like the military drop cards, only they had like information about why you shouldn't join the military in them, and dropped them in coffee houses right next to the military stuff. And, you know, when people pick up stuff at coffee houses, everything kind of gets mixed up anyways. So, you know, they all kind of got mixed up. We would run around and like organize whole campaigns to steal recruiter literature off college campuses and high schools. We organized a couple of raids on the recruitment station and like stole all their literature and then left. And we did a lot of like culture building, like counterculture building, and we were trying to build a culture of resistance in specifically focused on the west side of town. So we sponsored a lot of like punk shows and stuff like that, and a lot of hip hop shows, open mic nights at coffee shops and stuff like that. Flyered outside the high school, Lakewood High School, like incessantly. It was like, you know, 2 or 3 times a week we're out in front of that high school. And then we sent a letter to the school board that was like, yeah, we want you to kick off military recruiters because they're homophobic and, you know, you're not allowing another opinion on campus. We didn't challenge them under some like law. We challenged them under like theories of education, like confronted them at a school board meeting that the Channel 5 was at. We're like, you're feeding these kids all these lies and you're not allowing anyone else to counter them. What kind of educators are you? What's wrong with you? And like, it was like a huge thing, and like we got all this like counterculture media all around it. And by the end of the year, Lakewood High School had banned recruiters from every single thing except job fairs. And their school board was like giving speeches openly at like assemblies about what students need to reach, like watch out for when they're dealing with recruiters, because recruiters lie to them all the time. And it started an anarchist group at Lakewood High School. There were kids doing workshops on globalization at the local coffee shop. And like it kind of kick-started this whole culture, which fed in a lot to like groups like Food Not Bombs and Anarchist Black Cross, and like spread out from just doing counter-recruitment, but became something which questioned the entirety of our environment and how that environment shapes us as people. So.
I'm Tristan, I'm from Chicago. I did a lot of counter-recruitment work when I was in high school, forming numerous different groups throughout high school, both on campus and off. We weren't successful in getting recruiters off our campus, but we succeeded in every time that there were recruiters there, we would have some sort of action, which ended up in a lot of consequences. But luckily with community support, we managed to, usually the consequences were very minimal. But then I went to college. I only went to college for about three or four months before I decided my time would be better spent as a full-time activist, and I could go to school any other time in my life, but I felt like I'd be wanting to do that right now. And when I was on campus, we formed this coalition called Students Against the Militarization of Our Youth, SAMI. And I happened to go to the largest community college in the country with over 30,000 students enrolled. Students would come from all over the country just to attend because it was such a great community college. And as a result of it being a community college, and as a result of most of the people attending not having the financial capabilities of going to a university, there were recruiters on our campus all the time. They were scheduled twice a month. They would be allowed on our campus. Like tabling, they were scheduled twice a month. And so whenever they were on our campus, we would do the typical, you know, we'd have a booth across from them, and we would show anti-war films and try to have like visual effects. Like there was a die-in a couple times in front of the recruitment booth. But then we noticed that recruiters kept coming to campus when they weren't scheduled, and they would just find an empty table in the hallway and sit at it, or they would just simply pull up their vans or their cars up to campus and just walk around campus and talk to people. So we realized that we had to use other tactics other than just setting up a booth across from them, that wasn't working because that was working, which is why they kept coming back on days that they weren't scheduled. So what we did was, whenever we would see a recruiter on campus, which was pretty much at least three times a week, we had a phone tree, and we would call the students who were on campus that day, and whoever was closest to the student relations office, which is basically in charge of campus groups and things of that sort, and who was allowed to be on campus, what speakers were allowed to come, if military recruiters were allowed on what days, we would go to that office and inform them that there are recruiters here, and recruiters were not supposed to be there that day. And according to campus policy, then the student activities would then have to approach the recruiters and tell them that they had to leave. So that usually took about 2 hours to actually get a student activities person out of the recruiter. So in the meantime, while we had students inside student activities dealing with the faculty, we would also have students dogging the recruiters. Not with personal attacks, not with going up and screaming in their face, but just simply following them. And we were lucky to have one member of our group who was a current member of the National Guard. And what we would do is we would follow them with basically with the truth.